All right, everybody, good morning. It's a happy thing to break up people who are enjoying each other's company. Well, it's not happy to break them up, but it's happy that everybody's enjoying each other's company. Did I even say that right? All right, I'm going to work my way through some announcements. And when I'm all done with the announcements, then I'll teach a Bible study. But between teaching the Bible study and me being done with announcements, I'll let Miles come up and fill in anything that I left out. Okay, so let me try and begin here the best I can. All right, number one, let's talk about today. Well, you're here right now. Thanks for coming. I don't know what you're going to be doing afterwards, but I'm going to tell you what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to go at 10 minutes to 12. I'm going to be down off the ship, in front of the ship, and I'm going to go with whoever wants to come to go visit the SAT-7. Why did SAT-5 come into my mind? It's SAT-7. The SAT-7 studios, they're Persian language studios that just happen to be right here in Limassol. Ray Heinen has arranged this because he works for SAT-7. I'm just interested. Ray's over there and his wife, Sue. I'm really interested in this. Anybody else is welcome to come. We're just going to take taxis over there, fit however many we can in a taxi. Taxi would be 15 or 20 euros. It's like a 15 or 20 minute drive from here. We're going to allow ourselves plenty of time because there may not be taxis right here available at the port. But we're going to get to the studios about 12:30, and it'll be about an hour tour. So if you're interested, come on along. I'm very curious. And since we have a really ongoing work in the Middle Eastern world and with our Farsi commentary translation, this is a particular interest to me. But I don't want to assume it's of interest to anybody else. But me and a couple guys from the board will be going over there to just check things out. And you're very welcome to come. You'll want to bring with you, of course, your ship card, your name tag. They're going to want to see that through the tour. And of course, bring your passport. We don't know for sure that that's necessary, but bring it. Just that. Okay? 10 minutes to 12, we're going to meet right out at the front of the ship. Any questions about that? Ray, did I miss anything?
All good.
Okay.
Do you have an approximate number how many it's going to be?
Raise your hand if you're interested in this. Okay, so what do we got, like 10? Something like that? 10, 12 maybe? Okay, good. Yeah, we'll cram as many as we can in a couple of taxis. People riding in the trunk. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, tomorrow, we've got a day at sea. And am I correct, Miles? That is our last day at sea for the trip because of the reschedules. So we're going to meet here again tomorrow at 10 a.m. We'll do another time here in the morning. But we'll kind of figure out that might be our last time together here. I'm trying to figure if we're going to do it on the rest of the shore days, even though some people will be off doing excursions, but maybe the people who aren't. Maybe I'll get together and teach a Bible study for four people here. I don't know. I've done plenty of that before in my life, so we'll just see. But for sure, tomorrow at 10 a.m., we'll be meeting here. I do want to add, a lot of people are wondering, what about excursions in our coming stops? Our coming stops are Mykonos, Rhodes, in this order,
Santorini,
Bodrum, and then Ephesus. And then we go to Athens. So it's just 5 days after that. We are trying to line something up for Bodrum. I don't know if we're going to be able to pull it off. You could pray if you want that things could come together for it. It's really a bit of a logistical challenge and just to see if we can do it. But we're in contact with our travel agency back in the States because they would have to coordinate buses. And what we would do is travel by bus, and this is part of the problem. It would be some distance by bus, hour and a half, maybe even 2 hours. But if we can do it, we'd be going to Laodicea, Hierapolis, Colossae, that area. And let me tell you, having been there before, it's spectacular and really interesting biblical sites. Now, I almost feel bad saying that to you because it may not happen. We're working on it. But what I do want to emphasize is that's the only excursion we're working on, except, of course, for Ephesus. Ephesus is all set up. Nothing you got to do about that. That's going to happen no matter what. I shouldn't say that, should I? Give him the, that's a, ooh. Man, that's a, whew. What does James say? God willing. Yes. Whew, man. It's a little warm in here, isn't it? Okay, so that's what's going to happen at Ephesus. We're seeing if we can line something up for Bodrum. As for the other stops, Santorini, Mykonos, Rhodes, I know some of you have tried to set up excursions to this ship, and you've been frustrated because they're all full. It's just there's nothing there. You got a couple options, and let me tell you what the options are. One option is, I would say three options. If you can get online, just Google Mykonos excursions, and you can line up your own thing. There's lots of people who do this anyway, even that because it's usually cheaper if you do it that way rather than going through the cruise company. So don't feel like you're limited to just the excursions you can line up through celebrity. There's lots of excursions that happen, and so you can do it yourself. The other thing you can do is you can, and this is, of course, a little bit riskier, but there's excursions that you can just do at walking off the port. You just walk off on the port, and there's different guys in booths or different things, and you can line up things like that. Or, and this is what we did on the cruise 4 years ago on both Mykonos and Rhodes, we just rented a car and drove around and had a wonderful time in those places. But what I want to tell you is, no knock against Limassol, but there's not a lot to do here. Mykonos, Rhodes, and Santorini are not like that. There's cool stuff to do all around. So we're not going to arrange any of that for you. You'll have to figure it out either online, spur of the moment, or just be creative and do it yourself. But I do want to assure you that there's a lot more to see and do at those places than there is here in Limassol. Okay, so Miles, what else am I forgetting here?
Kind of hit everything.
Okay, wow.
A couple things. Okay. So on that point of going online and looking at some of the places, the place that I was looking at here in Limassol yesterday is a website called Viator, V-I-A-T-O-R.com. If you go on Viator.com, you're going to see that there are a ton of options for each of those places, Mykonos, Santorini, and Rhodes. Again, we're going to be in Mykonos on October 11th, Wednesday, October 11th, in Rhodes on October 12th, Santorini on October 13th, and Bodrum, Turkey on October 14th. We are trying to work on something. We have a tour company in Turkey that we've worked with in the past. In fact, they're the ones who planned our Ephesus tour named Seasong Tours. And I'm trying to be in contact with the head of Seasong Tours to see if we can do something in Bodrum. So much prayer. If the Lord wills, we will do this or that. That's what James
That's
says.
Right.
So,
yes.
So we want to pray that the Lord would open a door. But for sure, look at the Viator website. That's one place to go to because they still have a ton of options. But I will say they're already getting a little red tag on some of them that says may be sold out soon. So you can bet there are a whole bunch of people going on that same website trying to plan for it. You have a question, Sue?
I just wondered, are we ever going to try and do baptism anymore?
So one of the things that I'm hoping is the possibility of maybe doing it at Rhodes. There's some great beaches in Rhodes. So I will let you know. I'm in the process of trying to work on something online right now. So check out that website, Viator.com. That has a whole bunch of different things. You just put in the location that you're going and the date that you'll be there, and it will give you a long list of, there's probably 10 to 15 different options for each of those stops. But like David said, in Mykonos, you know, my wife and I, we really loved Mykonos the last time we were there. You just walked off the boat and walked into the city, and it was just a beautiful Greek island. And Santorini is known throughout the world as like the place to go in Greece. So there's going to be some very beautiful things to see there. But definitely check out those websites if you are interested in some tours in those places. Denise? Yes, so we are going to be in Mykonos Wednesday, October 11th, in Rhodes Thursday, October 12th, Santorini Friday, October 13th, and Bodrum, Turkey, Saturday, October 14th. And one of the real challenges, even Chuck had just shown me this as he was coming down, one of the concierge TVs shows different dates for those. These are the official dates, so...
One of those was delivered to every room.
Yeah, this should be in your room. One more question? Yeah.
Well, maybe everybody knows this, but and there's a story that goes with this, but if you take a tour on your own and it's not ship sanctioned, if you don't get back to the ship in time, the ship does not wait for you.
Yes. Take careful note of this paper that was left in your room. When it talks about what time the ship is leaving, they don't wait for you. And Mike and Sandy Sove have a wonderful story about that. Mike, if you're here, you can talk with them about their wonderful story of almost missing the ship. They told me about it. It was really great. So
almost missing.
Almost. They were the last ones on as they ran.
How stressful.
And people cheered from them for them from the deck of the boat. It was like the Amazing Race, they told me. It's awesome. So don't be that person.
Yes.
Yes. All right, if you have any further questions, come talk to me afterwards. I will be here. And David.
Thank you, Miles. Okay, I'm thinking a lot about this whole dynamic of the Mediterranean world and the impact that Jesus Christ and the church that he founded had on the Mediterranean world. And as I was thinking about that, I was thinking about the interaction that Jesus had with Gentiles in his ministry, non-Jews. And do you realize it was very rare that Jesus had an interaction with Gentiles? I mean, let's just kind of think of it. Who did Jesus interact with Gentiles? Well, there was the centurion that came to Jesus. That's correct, right? There was obviously Pontius Pilate. Anybody else? Thief on the cross very well could have been Jewish. Matter of fact, the word thief there has the connotation of like insurrectionist. So he could have been a insurrectionist against Rome. Yeah, I wouldn't assume, yes?
The Samaritan woman,
that's a good one. That's right. Yeah, you know what? I completely forgot about that because I shouldn't do this, but in my mind, I'm putting the Samaritans in like a different category, and they're a little bit different, but they're definitely Gentiles. Good one. The Syro-Phoenician woman. Lance, thank you for that because that's what I'm going to talk about right now. And I'll tell you, you'd think that was a plant, wouldn't you? No, it wasn't. And let me tell you what's fascinating to me about Jesus' interaction with the Syrophoenician woman was it was the only Gentile that he sought out. You know, he was brought before Pilate. The Samaritan woman came to where Jesus was at the well. The Roman centurion came and met Jesus. The Syrophoenician woman in Matthew chapter 15 was a Gentile that Jesus deliberately sought out. So let's take a look at that story together here. Matthew chapter 15, I'm going to begin at verse 21. Verse 21, then Jesus went out from there and departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. Tyre and Sidon is modern day Lebanon. They didn't call it Lebanon in Jesus' day. They called it Phoenicia. And Tyre and Sidon were Phoenician cities. They were important cities. They were prestigious cities. And what's so fascinating about this is, apart from Jesus' time as a young child in Egypt, right? Remember, because when Herod decided to massacre the children, Joseph and Mary fled to Egypt, and then they came back from Egypt, and they didn't come back to Bethlehem or the Jerusalem area. They came to Nazareth. But Jesus was just a child or just a boy. During the years of his adulthood and his earthly ministry, this is the only time that we know that Jesus left Israel proper. Now, there's a little bit of debate you could have over that, because Jesus did move among what's called the Decapolis. And those were notable Roman Gentile cities, but in the general area of Galilee, Judea, Samaria, what would have been considered centuries before in the days of ancient Israel, the land of Israel. This is the one exception where Jesus deliberately went out of there, as it says right there in verse 21, departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And friends, this was no accidental journey. This would have been a journey of 2 or 3 days. In the days of Jesus, people commonly walked about 20 miles a day. Obviously, there's variation. Some people less, some people more. But 20 miles a day is a pretty good average for somebody traveling. And this meant Jesus would have walked 2 or 3 days to go from Capernaum, Galilee, all the way to Tyre and Sidon. By the way, several years ago, I took something of a hiking tour through Israel. It's not like we camped out. We stayed in hostels or in hotels or this or that. But we just did a lot of hiking through places in Israel. And one of the places that we hiked would have been the trail that Jesus and his disciples took from the Galilee region up to Tyre and Sidon. We didn't do the whole trail, but we did a pretty good portion of it. And man, it was gnarly. It was really difficult because this was a trail that, as often as the case, it went along a creek or a stream bed. And you wouldn't call it a river, but it was one of those places that when it rains a lot, swells, and it can really mess up the trail when there's big rains. Well, they had just recently had big rains, and so the trail was really disrupted. And it was a very adventurous hike to go through there. But it was just very vivid on my mind. Jesus and his disciples would have gone through either this trail or a very similar one, a trail going over the same territory, on their way to Tyre and Sidon. Now, again, what I want to stress was so unusual about this is that Jesus, and we're going to see this later on in verse 24, Jesus said that his ministry was to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Very consciously, Jesus said, I did not come to minister to the Gentile world. I've come to minister to the lost sheep of Israel. Now, very deliberately, Jesus established a church, a community of his disciples that would be charged with the commission to reach all nations. Jesus wasn't heartless or blind or uncaring to those who needed the Messiah outside of Israel, but he knew he had come in his first coming to the lost sheep of Israel and then establishing the church, they would reach out to reach all the nations on earth. But Jesus himself only went this one time during the days of his earthly ministry outside the geography of what would have been Israel in Old Testament times. Now, this is not unusual in God's bigger plan. God has often called people to go to a different place. You can say that in some ways it makes a message more important, at least in the perception of people, when people travel to deliver it. I remember one time we were on a missions outreach trip to Australia. And there we are. Mike, I don't know if you were on one of those trips. Yeah. Yeah, there we are. We're just out there passing out tracts. We're doing just festivals and stuff like that. And there we are in this particular part. And I remember how incredulous Australians would be that someone would travel from California to come and tell them about Jesus. And what was interesting about was instantly it made the message more valuable in their eyes. It's like, well, this must be important. This guy traveled a long way to tell me it. And so God sort of uses that dynamic a lot. So God called a Babylonian, or you could say a Chaldean, named Abraham to a place called Canaan. God called a son of Israel named Joseph to another place called Egypt. God called an Israelite named Moses to Egypt again. God called an Israelite named Jonah to another place called Nineveh. God called a Jewish prophet named Obadiah to speak to another people, the Edomites. God called a Judean named Daniel to a place called Babylon. God called a Jew named Peter to preach to a Roman centurion named Cornelius. And God called a Jewish Pharisee named Paul to preach to the Gentiles, even making him the apostle of the Gentiles. So this is just a common thing that God will take somebody from one place, send them to another place, and use them as a servant. Of course, God doesn't always work that way. Sometimes God uses us just right where we were, right where we grew up. That's possible too. But God works in these ways. But what I want you to understand is that Jesus, when he went to Tyre and Sidon, not only did he go to a different place, but he went to a hostile place. The ancient Jewish historian Josephus notes that the people of Tyre and Sidon, Tyre especially, had a lot of animosity against the Jews. Didn't bother Jesus. Jesus takes his disciples. Could you imagine the disciples complaining along the way? We got to walk 3 days there and 3 days back for this? Jesus says, don't worry, I know what I'm doing. Verse 22. And behold, a woman of Canaan came from that region and cried out to him. Stop right there in that first part of that. That's fascinating. Okay, Lance, what did you call this lady?
Syrophoenician.
Is that what Matthew calls this lady?
No.
No. I forget which gospel it's in. Is it in Luke, maybe, where he calls him the Syrophoenician woman? Here, Matthew calls this woman a woman of Canaan. Now, Matthew, as you would know, is a gospel that was fundamentally written to a Jewish audience. And Matthew's trying to paint a contrast here. He's writing it with a pretty bold pen. And here's the contrast. This woman is not a Jew. Matter of fact, if anything, she's among an accursed people, the Canaanites. Because he's using this unusual phrasing. People weren't generally called Canaanites in that day. It was kind of an archaic term. It would almost be like if you called somebody today from Italy a Roman. And not that they were from Rome, but that you just called them a Roman. It's like, well, wait a minute, that was a long time ago, wasn't it? Well, the Canaanites were a long time ago in Jesus' day. But Matthew chooses this term just to highlight for us to say, this woman is not Jewish, and if anything, she comes from an accursed people. All right, back to verse 22. And behold, a woman of Canaan came from that region and cried out to him, saying, have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed. All right, that just pulls at your heart, doesn't it? Can you imagine the desperation of this woman? Could there be anything worse than feeling that your own child, your daughter, is possessed by a demon and there's nothing you can do? And to show you the depths of this woman's identification with her daughter's need, and to us it sounds so natural that we would pass over it. But you see her phrasing, have mercy on me, for my daughter is demon-possessed. She's not trying to say, oh, man, you think my daughter's got problems, I've got even bigger problems. No, 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 that's not the idea at all. The idea is, I so love my daughter that her problems are my problems. Have mercy on me, Jesus, because my daughter is severely afflicted. She's demon-possessed. Now, I want you to notice the phrasing that she uses. First of all, she asked for mercy. Mercy is what the undeserving receive. If you deserve it, it's not mercy. When you are guilty of speeding, you don't want the traffic cop to give you what you deserve. You're pleading for mercy. I know I was speeding. I'm pleading for mercy. If you're a woman, you got a way of working up a few tears when you make that plea. And I don't know, maybe sometimes it works. Have mercy on me. She understood that she was asking for something that she didn't deserve. But then notice the phrasing next. Have mercy on me, O Lord. Okay, if you stop right there. That ancient word there, and I'm just going to assume, look, it's not like I did a Greek preparation of this study. I'm going to assume that it's using the ancient Greek word kurios there. And kurios is an interesting word. It's a little bit like the old English word Lord, which could be used as just a respectful address. You know, good morning, my Lord. You know, it could be used as that. Or it could be used as an address to deity. And this is especially because of how the Old Testament used that phrase. Because she links together Lord and the phrase Son of David, I think she means more than Mister. Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. Do you understand what the title Son of David means? Okay, what was Jesus's adopted human father named David? No. His name was Joseph. Shouldn't she have called him Son of Joseph? No, because Son of David was a very clear and understood messianic title. Because God promised back in 2 Samuel that the Messiah would come from the lineage, from the royal line, from the house of David. It's interesting. You could say genetically, Jesus the Messiah is descended from Adam, is descended from Noah, is descended from Abraham, is descended from Jacob or Israel, is descended from Judah. All those things are true, but he's never given the title son of those things. No, what is he given the title of? Son of David, because of the special covenant that God made with David, recorded in 2 Samuel, and I also believe, 2 Chronicles? It's recorded in there, the covenant that God made with David, that the Messiah would come from his royal line. When she says, have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David, she's saying, I believe you're the Messiah. Pretty radical thing. Now, put this in contrast with the bigger context of the Gospel of Matthew. Because, you know, we're kind of parachuting down into chapter 15. In the bigger context of the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus is being rejected by the Jewish religious leaders. And so we as readers, when we read this, we're shocked. We're like, his own people are slow to recognize him as the Messiah. And this Gentile woman, this Canaanite, comes to Jesus and says, you're the Lord. You're the Son of David. I got to say, this speaks to me so powerfully about how we can find faith in Jesus Christ in unexpected places. I was thinking about this, just, you know, you read the news. Look, I don't want to sugarcoat it. There's a lot of people in the world today who are flat out enemies of Jesus Christ. There are people in this world who just think Christians should be slaughtered or subjugated. That's true. But you know what? God can do a work even among them. The tendency in our flesh is to write those people off. Or to create in our mind that they're an enemy that we have to despise. Friends, let me tell you here. There are potential Sauls of Tarsus among some of the greatest enemies to the work of God in the world today. Isn't that remarkable to think? Because if you think about finding faith in unexpected places, wouldn't you put a guy named Saul of Tarsus up at the top of your list? I mean, he was the last one in the world, but God knew how to get a hold of a man like that. And you know, when you see, if you see, horrific things in social media or on the news, you should use it as an occasion to pray. Lord, these people seem very far from you and very dangerous. Lord, would you find one or many, a Saul, a Tarsus from among them? God can do that. He finds people, he finds faith in very unexpected places. So, she says again, have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed. Now, verse 23, but he answered her not a word. Isn't that strange? Jesus, you walk 3 days to meet with this woman. And when she comes and makes this impassioned, heartfelt response, calling you the Messiah, you ignore her. I think it was Augustine who said of this, kind of trying to paint on the irony of this, he said, the word answered her, not a word. Like, what a strange thing that Jesus just wouldn't say anything in response. He answered her, by the way, this is not a recommended evangelistic technique. Jesus is operating in total submission to his Father. Jesus said in his ministry, I don't do anything except what my Father tells me to do. So, of course, Jesus is being led by his Father. He's being led by the Spirit of God. No doubt about this. There's divine wisdom in everything that Jesus is doing. But it's not a pattern for us in everything. But this is something remarkable. Okay, verse 23. But he answered her not a word. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, send her away, for she cries out after us. Jesus, would you please just get rid of this woman? Now, again, I'm not a scholar of the biblical languages at all. We got really lucky in, where were we, in Athens. And I was able to read a word in the museum, a Greek word there. Man, some of you were in our group? Let me tell you how lucky that was that I could read that one word. Drachma was the word. Lance, did you see that when your group? Okay. Our tour guide led us, and she took us to this tablet, and she said, can anybody here read Greek? And, of course, the people in my group are, like, pushing me forward. Yeah, come on, Mr. Bible commentary man. Go read some Greek for us. And I looked at it, and I'm like, oh, man, this is going to be so embarrassing, this. And I don't know, it was just like God having mercy on me. And I could see what the word was. It was drachma. And then she asked, well, do you know what that is? I go, yes, I remember the old Greek. It's money. Okay, good. So that was my, yes, thank you, Lord. But I don't know Greek or Hebrew. I just don't. But I can read the guys who do. And what they say is, the sense of the words that the disciples used here is not just get rid of her, but Jesus, would you answer her request and send her away? Give her what she wants and get rid of her. She's bugging us. That's basically what the disciples were saying. So look at Jesus' response here, verse 24. But he answered and said, now, since he's answering, it feels here that he's answering the disciples. I mean, I think you could debate, but here's the scene as I have it in my mind. Jesus isn't even talking to the woman. You know, there's the woman over there. He's going to, Jesus, just do, give this woman what she wants. She's really being a pest to us, which means that she probably said a lot more than what Matthew records. She said what Matthew records, but she was probably being very persistent in it. And the disciples are, guys, this is a headache. Would you get rid of this lady, please? You know? And it sounds like Jesus answered the disciples. Like, he's not even talking to the woman. He's still answering her, not a word. And he says, verse 24, I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. If you're that mom with a severely afflicted daughter, how does that make you feel? I tell you, this woman is an amazing example of persistent faith. And yet, you understand that Jesus read the situation perfectly and knew, because he's God, because he was submitted to his God and Father and the influence of the Holy Spirit, because of all this, because Jesus understood perfectly, I'm going to say this, because you can correct me if this is wrong. But he knew how far to push her, or maybe to pull her. He's pulling faith out of her. He's pulling persistence out of her. And he knows not to go too far, but he's going to make it a little uncomfortable for her. He's not going to. And look, sometimes people came to Jesus and they said, Lord, would you help me? And he goes, boom, yes, here it is. But there's other times like Jesus goes, well, let's talk about this. And he's forcing her to be more persistent. Sorry, you know what? I'm not even sent to people like her. I'm imagining he's not looking at her. I'm sent to the lost sheep of Israel, staring at the disciples. You know, guys like you, lost sheep. That's who I'm sent to. And then look at what she says next here. Verse 25. Then she came and worshiped him, saying, Lord, help me. Now, it says that she worshiped him. I don't doubt at all that it means that she worshiped him. She gave him worship, which, by the way, Jesus did not say, no, 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 lady, don't worship me, worship God alone. But that word for worship also means to bow down, to kneel. She's expressing it probably on her knees before Jesus, maybe grabbing at his feet. Lord, have mercy on me. Lord, what does she say specifically? Lord, help me. She came to Jesus, she worshiped him, and she cried out, Lord, help me. Now, I've done a couple teachings here already here in the Normandy room, and somebody chastised me a little bit, and they said, David, you haven't quoted Spurgeon once so far. So here's a Spurgeon quote on that phrase, Lord, help me. I commend this prayer to you because it's such a handy prayer. You can use it when you're in a hurry, or you can use it when you are in a fright. You can use it when you have not time to bow your knee. You can use it in the pulpit if you're going to preach. You can use it if you're opening your shop. You can use it when you're rising in the morning. It is such a handy prayer that I hardly know any position in which you could not pray it. Lord, help me. Isn't that beautiful? Just thought. What a great prayer to have on your lips, to live in that sort of dependence. So that's what the lady does. And then Jesus does this. It's like Jesus turns it up to 11 right here, verse 26. But he answered and said, it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs. Ouch, indeed. Lady, I know you're begging me to help your daughter. I know her need is your need. I know you're asking for mercy. I know you're worshiping me. I know you called me the Messiah. I know you're begging me to help you. But you know what? I got bread, but it's not for you. It's for the children. Now look, I could soften this. And it's not quite as rough as it sounds. It's not as rough. It is rough. But Jesus is, again, I rely on commentators for this. Jesus is using the diminutive form of dogs here, which has more in mind pets in a family, because dogs in that culture were usually seen as dangerous scavengers. It was used as a slur all the time. But using the diminutive, you know, doggies or kind of like that, Jesus is softening it somewhat. But he's softening it somewhat. He's not paying her a compliment. But what he has in mind here is at a home, and the children are eating bread at the table, and when the mom puts bread on the table, it's not for the dogs. The little dogs that are in the family, they might get the bits that fall on the floor. It happens like that all the time in your home, doesn't it? You have a dog that's like a vacuum cleaner. And you're like, praise the Lord for that. But that's the idea. It's a way of saying, kind of in a very stark, strong way, lady, this isn't for you. You're not one of the little children. And again, Jesus is like pushing, prodding her faith. And then, man, if you'd like to highlight things in your Bible, highlight verse 27. This like puts this woman on the all-star team of faith in the New Testament. This Canaanite, Syrophoenician woman, this Gentile who had no business believing on Jesus the way that she did. Look at what she says here in verse 27. And she said, yes, Lord, yet even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from their master's table. It's brilliant. Okay, in our modern day, a modern Syrophoenician woman here in the story would have said to Jesus, who are you calling a dog? How dare you? You know, that's really what a modern person would say. But what does this woman say? She goes, Jesus, you say I'm a dog? Fine, I'm a dog. I'll take that place. But you know, even the dogs get the crumbs. How about that, Jesus? And it's so brilliant. It's brilliant in that she doesn't try to contradict Jesus. It's brilliant that she just takes her place. But it's brilliant that she says, Jesus, don't you still have something for me? All I'm asking for is a crumb. I'm not asking to take the place of the children. But you've got some crumbs for me, don't you? And then in verse 28, then Jesus answered and said to her, now he's speaking to her. Matter of fact, it wouldn't be, is this the first time he speaks to her clearly in the text? It is, isn't it? Because first he answered her not a word. Don't you love it when I'm working out a Bible study right when I'm teaching it to you? You guys know this happens, doesn't it?
Never.
Yeah, because it sounds strange, but sometimes you actually think while you're teaching the Bible, and I'm thinking through this text. I never noticed. This is the first clear, direct word that he speaks to her. And what does he say? O woman, great is your faith. Let it be to you as you desire. And her daughter was healed from that very hour. We do not have it recorded in the Gospels that Jesus ever said, oh, great is your faith, to any other person directly. Now, you might subject and say, well, didn't he say that regarding the centurion? Yes, but he told that to his disciples about the centurion. As far as we know in the Gospels, this is the only person that Jesus ever looked in the eye and said, you know what? Great is your faith. And it was the most unlikely of women that it seemed like Jesus was pushing her away. But yet what that seemingly was, she fought through it. She submitted to it. And then she said, Jesus, I'm still going to come and ask. I'm still going to come and think that you have mercy to give me, you have crumbs to give me. And Jesus said, here, I'll meet your need. I would venture to say that every one of us in our walk with God has experienced some time where it felt like, in some way or another, Jesus was kind of pushing us away, or let's just say, keeping us at arm's distance. I know I'm talking about feelings. I know it's a little bit subjective here, so I don't want to get too deep into that. But there are times when you have a sense that you're in the Lord's embrace. Okay? Then there's other times where you just feel like maybe you're a little bit at arm's distance. I'm just here to tell you that God has a purpose in both. And don't despise a time when Jesus may be, so to speak, responding to you in a way that would stretch your faith. Take that place before him and still rely on the fact that he's Messiah. Rely on the fact that he's Lord. Continue to worship him and continue to believe that he has good things for those who seek him. And that's what this woman did. And then you'll hear that same appellation from Jesus that he gave. Great is your faith. Right, that's the personal application. Let me give a bigger application, kind of in the world at large. God can still raise up great faith from really unexpected places. And the Lord can still do that. I believe he is still doing that. Let's believe that he'll do that. There's a lot of turmoil in the world today. And even those who are very involved in the turmoil, man, wouldn't it be awesome if God raised up some really unlikely people of great faith in the midst of that? I want to believe that he can. Because if I could put it this way, I would put it this way. You can look around the Mediterranean world and see a lot of unlikely people for faith in Jesus Christ. Agreed? So, believe that God can work in the midst of them. But you know what? You can look in the mirror and see an unlikely person, can you not? Don't think you're so different. Apart from Jesus, we're all unlikely. But as Jesus himself said, with God, all things are possible. Whether that unlikely person is in the mirror or in another place, another culture, another language, God works the impossible. Father, that's what we just want to remind ourselves of. And Lord, being right now in the Mediterranean world, we agree together in prayer, Lord, that you would raise up men and women of great faith from unlikely places. Lord, we know that we come from some of those unlikely places. But Lord, all around the world today, would you raise up some remarkable people to walk in the same footsteps that Saul of Tarsus walked in? Make some new men and women along those lines in the world today. In Jesus' name, amen.